I'm going to hand it over to Andrew now. You're listening to 88.3 Southern FM.
Saturn and wondering why time takes all you hoped and dreamed and waited and grew up upon. Oh, but I see that the rainbow has an end. I see that when you get there, you got to know there's always someplace else to go, someplace new. And look at the world keep changing, look at the world keep turning around me. I see all the little bits of sadness that should never be. Of broken hearts and false starts tumbling to the ground. Oh, but I see that the rainbow has an end. I see that when you get there, you got to know there's always someplace else to go, someplace new. And look at the world keep changing, look at the world keep turning.
Welcome to the Space Show, presented by members of the Space Association of Australia. Hello, I'm Andrew Rennie, and we'll tell you what that was and why we played it after this message.
The Great Southern Sounds of Melbourne, 88.3 Southern FM.
Yes, and that was, as you might have gathered, a song called Dr. Von Braun, and it was sung by Kathy Marr in 1984. Now, on this evening's The Space Show, as a Russian cosmonaut and an American astronaut begin a one-year stay aboard the International Space Station, we take a look at manned spaceflight. First, we reach deep into our archive and eavesdrop on German rocketry pioneers Wernher von Braun and Willy Ley as they discuss the progress being made in 1959 towards manned spaceflight. Now, 2 weeks ago, we had a long chat with one of the astronauts who rode the largest of von Braun's rockets, the 111-metre-tall Saturn V. Fred Hayes was on the way to become the sixth man to walk on the moon when an explosion ripped through his spacecraft. He and his two crewmates were lucky to make it back to Earth. This evening, Fred Hayes discusses his life before and after Apollo 13. And please get your diary handy, as we have several entries for it. We're now going to that conversation between Wernher von Braun and Willy Ley. This was recorded in 1959.
I think when we talk about manned space flight, the first attempt in this direction, the first serious attempt, will be the so-called Project Mercury, which is a program supported and financed and sponsored by the National Space Administration. On that program Mercury, it is planned to fire a manned capsule with an Atlas vehicle into a low orbit and let the capsule pilot go around the Earth several times, and then with the help of a retardation maneuver, this nose cone will slip back into the atmosphere, will be retarded by aerodynamic drag, and finally land in the water where it will be shipped, where it will be fished out of the water like our Jupiter nose cones with the monkeys aboard.
Yes.
This will definitely be man's first step into an orbit, and from there on, it doesn't take much imagination to see that with a big booster like the Saturn at the bottom of such a vehicle, you need not limit this to one man, but you can send a whole busload of people up into an orbit.
Yes, and what I mainly meant to point out was this, that the space station, as it has been discussed before, which has as its main job the observation of the Earth, will be in a rather low orbit, while the communication satellites, the telephone satellites, let's call them, have to be some 22,000 miles away.
Yes, actually, there is a question of whether it is realistic to talk about just one space station. It depends very much on what the purpose of such a station is. Shall we say, the choice of the orbit of a space station depends very much on its purpose.
Yes.
For example, if you want to use a space station to maintain a continuous surveillance of the weather development on Earth, then it is very important to put these such a satellite, such a space station, into a very into a near polar orbit, so that you can see the weather developments over the polar areas also.
Yeah. Yes, it would also have an orbit differently located, so to speak, with respect to the Earth. The telephone satellites would be over the equator.
That is right.
While this one should go over the poles or very near the poles.
Yes.
But what I've said first is that it also would be much nearer to the ground.
Yes, I think both is correct. My point is I think there may be several satellites for several applications. There may be manned space stations for in connection with the communication satellite project in the future, and there may be lower space stations going over polar orbits for weather observation,
yeah,
and there may be others in between.
Earth Watch, you know, polar orbit replaced the iceberg patrol at the same time.
Yes.
Weather reporting,
For military observational purposes, you want to have highly inclined orbits,
yes,
too, so you can,
yes,
cover the northern and the southern hemispheres.
And they could take in what might be called accident reporting. That's,
yes,
for example, a wrecked ship or things,
yes,
like this.
Yes.
They could report,
yes,
on that. Now, these would go very nearly over the poles, if not over the poles, and would be quite close. Then, is there any reason for having something at an intermediate distance? Let's say if this Earth Watch satellite, as I like to call it, is in a 400-mile orbit.
Well, I think we have to watch the Van Allen belt.
Yes, we sure do.
The Van Allen belt begins at an altitude of approximately 700 miles and stretches out to altitudes very close to those envisioned for the communication satellite.
Yes.
Whereas it doesn't seem to be too difficult to penetrate the Van Allen belt in a fast departure, say, to the moon or the planets, where your stay time in the Van Allen belt will be quite limited, There seems to be a major problem of leaving a permanent manned space station right in the Van Allen belt. It would have to provide so much shielding that the weight penalty is too high.
At the moment, it does not look impossible, but it certainly looks impracticable.
Yes, in other words, the way it looks today is you stay below it, which means below 700 miles approximately, or you just go much further
beyond
out.
Beyond 20,000.
But unless you have very good reasons to build a well-shielded space station right within the Van Allen belt, it is just not too attractive.
No, it's a little bit like the speed of sound. At 0.8 of the speed of sound, everything is fine. At 1.2, everything is fine again, but not in between.
Only this belt is a lot wider.
It's a lot wider. Well, the only reason I could see for a heavily shielded station in the belt would be one designed to observe the belt itself. And I think that could be done without a manned station.
Yes, actually, the human body has no sensors to give you any of the information you want. What we would like to find out right now, for example, is what is the percentage of protons and electrons in this belt? What is their energy spectrum and so forth? Now, the human body
The human observer couldn't do any
organs. You may be able to kill a man in that belt, but you still he still wouldn't know what exactly killed him. So you need instrumentation to give you this kind of information, and there's no reason why this cannot be radioed down to the ground from an unmanned satellite.
With reference to the first man in orbit, the flight of the astronaut, will he be carried into orbit by an Atlas missile, so to speak, cold, or will he have previous experience on a smaller scale?
That's a good question. The National Space Administration has actually called us here at Huntsville in to provide some hardware for the initial training flights of these astronauts. The plan is to put the man right from the beginning into the ultimate capsule, which will later on be used for the orbital flights with Atlases. But his first flights will be conducted from the nose of a Redstone vehicle only over a range of approximately 150 to 200 miles. In this fashion, we will give him a six-minute ride through the zero-gravity condition and a typical re-entry with ensuing parachute landing and being fished out of the water.
In short, the nose cone ride in a Redstone will provide him more or less with the experience, except that the zero-G period, which he would spend in orbit, has been trimmed from...
Pretty good feeling of what he will be up against when he finally boards that Atlas.
Will they all get the... Since it is not certain, and I understand it will not be certain until fairly much the last moment which one actually goes into orbit, will they all get such a nose cone ride?
I think this is to be expected, yes. We are furnishing several Redstone vehicles, and it's, of course, entirely up to the NASA, to the National Aeronautics and Space Administration, to decide who will take the first ride.
Yes, but I mean, they will have had several people who had the nose cone ride in preparation for the orbital flight.
Yes, you see, this is necessary to have several test pilots standing by, because you have to be in perfect physical conditions for these early tests, and it can always be that a man catches a cold and everything else has been prepared, the ships are in position, and the man wakes up with a head cold and doesn't qualify that day. In this case, the number two man will be slipped in.
Now, in talking about the investigation of the Van Allen layer, which is a most interesting, if unexpected, item that we didn't know about a few years ago, you said that for this particular observation, instruments are far superior to men because men happens to lack the organ which could make the determination, which could make the discoveries, if you want, that the instruments can. This, of course, brings up the general question of when is man needed in space? Where does he have to step in because his instruments now don't do the job anymore?
Well, I think very fundamentally, the instrumentation has its limits. You can design instrumentation for a known objective. You have to specify in advance what information you seek, and then build your instrumentation accordingly so that it furnishes you with the answers.
So you have to know what to look for in order to ask intelligent questions via the instrument.
Precisely.
Design.
And so, as I see it, man is necessary wherever you are confronted with a great unknown, where you just don't know what to look for and where you expect the unexpected, against which you cannot design any machinery. Just to illustrate my point, suppose we were living on another star and wanted to find out what kind of life exists in the Brazilian jungles. And you would have to build a telemeter package to furnish you all the answers about snakes and birds and crocodiles, but also bacteria
and insects, or plants,
and a question of contagious diseases and what have you in the Brazilian jungles. You'd be confronted with a rather formidable problem, because not knowing what to expect, you couldn't design this machinery to meet all your objectives. And as a result, the old-fashioned method of the Spanish explorers, for just sending a man there for a look-see, is still the most effective.
Yes, and of course now we would see to it that this man is well-protected, or as well-protected as we can make it. But it is then inherently the higher versatility of the brain over the instrument which counts.
Wherever you need judgment, wherever you need coordination of several apparently irrelevant and disconnected pieces of information and put a story together out of a number of apparently independent inputs, the human brain still cannot be beat.
And won't be for a long time.
No, I think never will.
Now, this gets us to the next topic. We can penetrate the Van Allen there. We can go out farther into space. Where will we go first?
Well, I think in the area of deep space penetration, the most logical step after manned orbital flight and safe return from orbital flight has been obtained and demonstrated, we will probably expect to send a few men around the moon on a long-stretched flight path behind the unknown far side of the moon, and return them back into the Earth atmosphere with an ensuing aerodynamic deceleration and landing. Now, such a flight would not include a landing on the surface of the moon.
No.
It would be essentially a high-speed power maneuver on the outbound leg to get us that far out. And then as the rocket comes almost to a standstill behind the moon would sweep through between rocket and Earth. And then it would fall back towards the Earth under the gravitational pull of the Earth and would tangentially sweep into the Earth's atmosphere and land.
Yes, so the first deep space trip for people is still, as we said many years ago, the
trip
flight
around
the moon without landing.
Yes.
Then, of course, when it comes to the neighboring planets, we have this nice toss-up that we know nothing about Venus at the moment, so this makes it more interesting, but we don't know what to protect against. While Mars doesn't look very hospitable, but at least we know a lot about it.
Yes. Well, as far as flights to Venus and Mars is concerned, the difficulties are about equal. It is a little closer to Venus to get there than to Mars, but Venus has a stronger gravitational field of her own, so it takes a little more velocity to put a rocket, say, into orbit around Venus than it would cost to put it in orbit around Mars.
Yes.
So it's about equal.
Yes, in spite of the somewhat greater distance to Mars, the engineering problem is very much the same, and the fuel problem is likely to be very much the same.
And as you just said, in the case of Mars, due to the fact that the atmosphere is transparent, we know a little better how to equip our machinery, how to build our automatic instrumentation to give us more information on Mars.
Yes, we know what questions to ask.
For example, photographing Mars surface from an orbit around Mars would be a very interesting thing, and we would know right now how to design such equipment. We could entirely envision televising such pictures back to the Earth and give us some answers to such riddles as, do the Martian canals really exist?
Are they canals?
Are they canals, or what are they? Whereas in the case of Venus, it would probably be necessary to send a kind of a glide bomb into the Venus atmosphere with television equipment and see whether that thing ever comes out of the Venus atmosphere and take some pictures on what's underneath, or whether it'll crash in the ground without telling us anything, thus indicating that the clouds go all the way down to the ground.
Yes, in other words, we do know enough about Mars to design equipment. In the case of Venus, we first would have to gather experience.
Yes.
We would have to almost engineer a number of failures in order to know how to avoid them.
Yes, yes.
And then, of course, man flight to these neighboring planets would follow these unmanned probes, which have given the final information.
Yes, I think to the planets we should expect unmanned probes first, maybe even one-way probes that just go out to the planet, either pass those planets in a close pass or go in orbit around these planets and televise their information and telemeter their information back to the Earth.
Yes.
Speaking in 1959, this is a conversation between Wernher von Braun and Willy Ley, two German rocket pioneers. Now, it's interesting to note that they mentioned there that they thought the first flight to the moon would be one that went out to the moon, around the back, and back straight back to the Earth. And indeed, our next guest did that, but it wasn't the first flight to the moon. We now return to our conversation with Wernher von Braun and Willy Ley on the Space Show on Southern FM.
And man, of course, will follow, as man always has.
Yes.
And now we come to a semi-philosophical question. What right does man have in space?
Well, it has been stated that we don't belong there because outer space is a realm of God and we better stay on this Earth. I don't like the implication of these statements because it could be construed as to mean that the Earth itself does not belong to the realm of God.
If you permit me to interrupt you, this is precisely the answer I gave once at a meeting where somebody came up with this question. I said, and now, in other words, the Lord is not present here.
Well, this is the way I feel about it.
A silent withdrawal. Mm-hmm. So this reasoning, of course, is primitive and nonsense.
Yes. I think if the Lord didn't want us to go into outer space, he would simply deny us the means of doing it. And the fact that he seems to support our projects and allows us to demonstrate
we do have the brains. Our bodies are built better for high accelerations than the bodies of any other animals except our relatives,
yes,
the primates. So it looks very much, if the term can be used here in this connection, like something preordained.
Precisely.
But I wanted to bring this up because that question does come up every once in a while, mostly from laymen, I mean now in the theological sense, because the theologians who have been thinking about this problem for about as long as we have been talking about the engineering problems are, of course, convinced that there is no obstacle from where they sit.
Well, the Pope himself has blessed the idea of flight into outer space during the meeting of the International Astronautical Federation in Rome in 1957, I believe, or was it 56?
No, 57.
57, and he stated very plainly that God has in no way limited man to this planet, and that the Catholic Church saw no objections whatsoever to this endeavor of exploring other worlds.
I read his statement both in the original French and the English translation. That's why I said the theologians, of course, who have been thinking about this, will not voice this objection. It comes only from circles of laymen.
I think it is a great tragedy that so many people still believe that religion and science are not compatible, and it's a fundamental struggle on between what you might call search for faith and search for truth. I think with every new mystery that science has solved, it has also discovered at least three new questions which science hasn't solved yet.
Yes.
And I think the closer we get to the facts and the more we learn about the mysteries of nature, the more we learn to adore and to just become more humble in our outlook.
Yes, and this is bound to happen. I have a quotation there from the French philosopher Pascal, which I love and which I have used before on occasion, where Pascal said that knowledge can be compared to an expanding sphere. The larger it grows, the more points of it will touch the unknown.
Yes.
That is precisely the same you just said before.
Yes.
As our knowledge expands, and this is to be, this time the word is to be taken literally, one day we will run into other life forms. And this, of course, is the second most favorite question that always comes up after every lecture about other life elsewhere.
Well, I think there's enough evidence today that at least some low forms of life exist on Mars.
Yes, that can be accepted as...
We know that whenever the snow melts on the northern or the southern polar cap of Mars and humidity reaches the moderate latitudes, that vegetation seems to spring into life, and large areas of Mars are covered by a bluish and greenish hue. In fall, on that particular hemisphere of Mars, this vegetation seems to wither, and these seasonal effects appear during every Martian year.
They come up every year, and there is one other little item which was very interesting. You said that the vegetation is bluish green or greenish blue. Well, a Russian astronomer by the name of Tikhov has been looking around on Earth for equivalent color values in vegetation, and he found them strangely enough in the North Siberian forests. And then he made additional measurements which gave the result that a forest in the temperate zone will radiate or reflect about 25% of the infrared of the heat rays that hit the leaves. The North Siberian forest cannot afford this. It does not reflect more than about 2% of the infrared rays. And the Martian plants have the same color value. They, of course, since Mars is farther from the sun, also cannot afford to waste any infrared that may strike them.
Mm-hmm.
So we are pretty certain about life on Mars, at least vegetation. But when the public asks this question, they always have something more than plant life in mind. They are not even interested just in the neighboring planets. They mean, well, they say the universe, they mean the galaxy as a whole.
Well, I have no doubt whatsoever that in the vast depths of the universe, there will not be just a few hundred, but probably millions of planets capable of supporting even higher forms of life. And I wouldn't be a bit surprised if there are some planets among them that are capable of supporting even a much higher form of life than this Earth. In other words, that there are intelligent beings around somewhere who, for whom we with all our intelligence would be no match.
Well, of course, this is the same way I feel about it. And I think the most interesting moment in history that could happen is if two such cultures meet.
Yes, it certainly would. Whether we'll ever be able to visit such a planet remains to be seen, but in 25 years of work in the missile and space field, I've always found out that whenever I use the word impossible, I ultimately wind up at the losing end.
You ultimately wind up building it.
Yes, I'm building it.
As two cosmonauts begin the one-year mission, the fourth time, the fourth time in human history that people have lived a year in space, in one continuous stretch, that is. We were listening to a conversation there recorded in 1959 between Wernher von Braun and Winnie Ley, two rocket pioneers. And, if you know anything about the history of human spaceflight, some of the things they predicted came true and others didn't. Coming up, we have someone who did do that moon mission, and that's Fred Hayes, right here on The Space Show. We can be
Join us this Saturday from 7pm to 10pm and then on Sunday from 2pm to 5pm when we bring you live matches of the Southern Football and Netball League. Matches of the day with Hammers, Johnny Tack and the award-winning radio team on 88.3 Southern FM, where the locals are the legends.
Where do you find the top names in premium kitchenware in one convenient location? Online at appliancekitchen.com.au. Scanpan, pots, pans and cookware. Russell Hobbs kitchen appliances. Noritake dinner sets. Breville blenders. George Foreman grills. Stanley Rogers cutlery sets and many more top brands to choose from. Appliancekitchen.com.au have all the top brands of premium kitchenware and appliances at great prices. And every customer who orders online now receives a complimentary gift. Fantastic kitchenwares, great prices and a complimentary gift, all from the comfort of your own home. For all your kitchenware needs, go to appliancekitchen.com.au. Proud sponsors of Southern FM.
Hi, this is Ross Wilson and I'd like to talk to you about Support Act. Support Act is an established, registered charity assisting those in the music industry suffering hardship through illness or injury. God, it could happen to me. If music has enriched your life, spare a thought for the many entertainers, writers and crew who, growing older, are now facing hard times. Support Act needs your support. Please donate and learn more at supportact.com.au.
This is the Space Show on Southern FM. This month marks the 45th anniversary of the Apollo 13 flight, which had an objective of making the third human landing on the moon. On the way to the moon, an oxygen tank in the service module exploded. The crew were able to fly the crippled craft around the moon and successfully return it to Earth. In the first of five weekly discussions, Peter Aylward chats with Lunar Module pilot Fred Hayes about his life before and after the event that, like it or not, has engraved his name into the public consciousness.
This is Peter Aylward on the Space Show, and we're joined by a very special guest, Apollo astronaut Fred Hayes. Fred, welcome to the Space Show.
Oh, thank you. Glad to be here. Talking a little long distance.
That's correct, yeah. So, Fred, we're talking now in just coming up to the 45th anniversary of your space flight, Apollo 13. 45 years later, how does it all feel for you? Recollections on the mission, what happened during the mission, and what happened subsequent to the mission?
Well, you know, the mission was one event in my life, and of course it was rather dramatic event. So I remember most of the, major parts, like the launch, entries, the explosion. So, you know, and there's segments of the mission like that that are just today as real as they were back then.
Sure.
Of course, I've had occasion over the years to talk about it a lot, many different events of all sorts.
Sure. Well, look, Fred, let's talk about the mission a little bit later on, because as you rightly point out, it's just one part of your amazing life. So perhaps we could rewind back to, well, maybe not the very start, but very early on in your life. I believe you were born in Biloxi, Mississippi, and grew up around there.
Yes, South Mississippi, a very small town, about 14,000 people at the time. It was a mixed town of fishing, waterfront. It was a very small tourist business. At the time, though, it was one of the largest suppliers of oysters and shrimp for the United States. They had a number of shrimp factories, they called them, probably about six of them that were active at that point in time. And, of course, as a boy, I spent a lot of time on the waterfront, a lot of swimming, a lot of fishing, that sort of thing through my life while there through through actually high school and then 2 years of junior college.
And I believe you still have a passion for fishing today, is that right?
I do, yes. I have. We have a second home in Mississippi at a little town called Gauche. The French pronunciation would be Gauche, I guess. But it's a small town today, probably about 10,000 population. And we have a home on a bayou that's off the Pascagoula River that's complete with alligators. But within a very short distance, I can fish freshwater in the bayou or drive about 2.5 miles in my boat, and I'm in the Gulf of Mexico, saltwater.
Wow. So is that like Cajun country down there? Is there the Cajun culture, the French-American sort of mixture of cultures and music?
No, not Biloxi. That's Louisiana. If you had the primary you look at from beyond the Gulf Coast area would be Slovakian. There's a large Slovakian population that is down at the east end of the town, settled in there, and they were mostly tied with the fishing industry. I don't know, the rest of the people there are probably from all over, and have since, of course, come in from all over. But that's probably, no, I wouldn't call it Cajun country.
Right. So, look, I've read a note here back in your early days when you were young, you actually had a bit of an apprehension of flying. And now, obviously, you've turned out to be an accomplished pilot. You must have overcome that apprehension.
I didn't have apprehension. It was just I never had any interest.
Okay.
I had never, really never had been even inside of an airplane sitting on the ground when I went off to flight training. I'd never flown in anything, airliner or anything. And I guess the apprehension was when I got into flight training and pre-flight, quite a number of my classmates had flown and were talking about their flight experiences in light airplanes. And so I was a little worried about they knew a lot more than I knew about the subject and how I was going to fare when I got into really the flying part.
And you came into that through the Naval Aviation Cadet Program, is that correct?
That's correct. It was the only program. I had finished high school at 16 years old, and I went through 2 years of junior college. So at 18, with 2 years of college during the Korean War, that was the only service I could get into that would lead to a commission, which was really my primary goal, not the wings and flying, but that was the only program that would lead to the commission. So that's how I jumped in, and obviously I took to the flying a lot when I got into it.
Sure. So we're talking early 50s here, Fred. 52.
Right, this is 1952.
Right.
That's when I went in.
Fantastic. And then from that you graduated and got your wings and you were flying with the U.S. Marine Corps, is that correct?
That's correct. I had a choice. I actually was a Navy cadet, as everybody was in that program. Went in without a commission. And I really was planning on staying Navy because my father was Navy. He was an emergency Marine, and he for 12 years, and then he joined the Navy during World War II and was in the Navy then. So, but I got to advanced training where they make the assignments at Advanced Training Command, and I went into the office where they assign you, and they were going to put me in the seaplanes. So when they were going to put me in the seaplanes, I decided I'd become a Marine cadet, which simply meant primarily changing your belt, the belt you wore on your cadet uniform. Because I knew in Marines I'd either end up with a TAC or a fighter-type aircraft.
Right, so primarily you weren't as interested in the heavy, slow, larger aircraft. You wanted to get the fast jets, yeah?
That's right, yeah.
Fantastic, okay. And then from there you were there for quite a while, and I think you then did a Bachelor of Science, is that correct, during that time? A Bachelor of Science, is that correct?
Well, no. What happened was I went into the Marine Corps and I was served in two squadrons, BMF 533, which had Banshee, McDonnell Douglas aircraft, and the second squadron, BMF 114, had Cougars, Swept-Wing Grumman aircraft. And when I got out of the Marine Corps, by that time I had figured out, thought at least, I wanted to become a test pilot. And the road to be a test pilot required you to have an engineering degree. So I went back to school then on the GI Bill at the University of Oklahoma. And while there, I continued flying high-performance aircraft in the Oklahoma Air National Guard while I was in college for 3 years to get my engineering degree. And with that, I joined NASA. It was an opening at Lewis Research Center at in Cleveland, Ohio, which is now Glenn Research Center, named after John Glenn.
Right.
And in fact, my trail then through NASA was, and it just had become NASA, in fact, at that time in 1959. It became NASA in 58. I basically followed in Neil Armstrong's footsteps. Neil was 2.5 years ahead of me. He started at Lewis in Cleveland. Then he had transferred to NASA Flight Research Center at Edwards Air Force Base in California, which now is named after Neil. It's Armstrong Flight Research Center. And so I did the same thing. After 3.5 years at Lewis, I transferred to Edwards and then followed Neil into the astronaut program.
When did you meet Neil? Did you get to know him back in those days, or was it only after?
Oh, yes, I knew him when I would go out to Edwards from Lewis. So I knew him when he was still, before he joined the program, before he joined the astronaut program, when he was flying overlapped, and he was flying the X-15
right. At
that time.
Okay. During that time, was that when you were involved in the lifting body program? I believe you flew some lifting bodies?
No, I really was slated to fly in the powered flight portion of it, what we call the heavyweight vehicles, that were carried up by the B-52 and launched much like the X-15. The only flights I got, I and Joe Engel, they gave us a chance to fly on tow behind a very fast vehicle across the lake bed, where we could get up to several hundred feet with this lightweight version and just feel out the control system and do a landing off of a long rope tow.
No,
I never actually flew it airborne in beta landing after I was in free flight.
Right. So was that the RD-4 aircraft that you're talking about there? Or?
Oh, it was the M2F1.
Okay.
Right. The first heavyweight was the M2F2, and after it crashed, which became the opening scene of the $6 Million Man TV show,
yes,
it was retrofitted to the M2F3 where they added another vertical tail in the center to give it a little better directional stability.
Right.
But no, I did a lot of preliminary work to the lifting body program, flying a variable stability. Looking at different models, the handling characteristics of models that had been wind tunnel tested at Ames and at Langley, NASA Langley, those two centers. And from that, out of those multiple, I'm talking like 30 or 40 models, the ones that were chosen to eventually build were the M2 F2 and the HL-10 aircraft. And so that I was involved in that preliminary work. And then with a variable stability T-33, specially modified, where this, rather than tip tanks, they modified it where it had speed brakes out at the ends of each wing that could flare open, so it could emulate the drag of a lifting body. And through the computers, it could make it handling quality similar to what it would be for the various the types of lifting bodies we chose eventually to build and fly.
So I
had to adapt the program to it's sort of the preliminary before we got to flying the actual lifting bodies.
So the objective of those lifting body program, was that for return from space type vehicles, or what was the sort of the core objective of that program?
Well, I'm not sure overall, but at least the idea I had and others that were flying at the time, we thought it would be the type of vehicle that could survive a Martian reentry, which was going to be up around 60,000, 70,000 foot a second, whereas lunar entries are about 36,000 second. So you really could probably not rig a machine to survive that heating with wings.
Right.
The lifting body. In fact, the M2, F2, F1 and F2 were virtually, if you looked at the shape, it was almost like you took an ICBM nose cone and sliced it through. And so we knew it was a good shape. And, of course, they did a lot of wind tunnel and arc jet tests. So it was good for to handle that kind of a heating regime. So that's what it was looked at the time. Of course, it's the flown lifting bodies. The Air Force has one, as you know, that's gone up and stayed over a year, I think, and recovered a couple of times. And one of the early proposals for the shuttle, the one Lockheed proposed, and the their submittal was a lifting body rather than a vehicle. Of course, Rockwell was chosen, which has the Delta wing space shuttle. But so it was looked at for other things as well.
Sure. And, of course, if we fast forward 20 years, you were then involved with the approach and landing test for the actual space shuttle prior to its getting sent into space. Tell me a little bit about that program and how it related to your early experience with the lifting body.
Okay, well, that was, I'll call it from my standpoint, looking at my overall participation in the early development was the, call it the crowning event of my career, really, because I left the astronaut office in 1972 and joined Aaron Cohen, who was heading the Orbiter Project Office. Aaron later became Senator Director of Johnson Space Center, but at the time he was the Director of the Development for the Orbiter component of the space shuttle system, which, as you know, is the complex part. The other parts are that sort of big gas tank that has some stuff in it and two solid rockets, you know, that on the hung on the sides. So anyway, I was involved in the program office for almost 4 years. I led an ops team through all of the design reviews, up through critical design review on Enterprise, and through preliminary design review on Columbia, first orbital bird, and sat on an engineering change board as a, you want to call it a member, a voting member, and was active in a program office sense at all of reviews at the various contractors throughout that period. And then I went back to the astronaut office and was fortunate enough to be named commander of Crew 1, where we only had two crews named to fly that approach and landing test program that we flew in 1977. One crew, the crew I had was with Gordon Fullerton, and the other crew was Joe Engel and Dick Truly. Dick, as you know, later became administrator of NASA later in his career. So we were the only two crews that really got to fly Enterprise. We flew an 8-flight test program, and I got the Gordo and I got to fly 5 of the 8 flights we flew in that program. It was a very successful program for a test program. I think we had one problem on flight. Joe and Dick's first flight, I think, they had a hydraulic a leak in the hydrazine that feeds the APU systems, and it did fortunately only in the F compartment only burn through a few wires that weren't that essential, and of course they made a normal landing. It ended well. But that was about the only problem we had, and through that program it was a very successful test program for that complex a piece of machinery.
I mean, the space shuttle has been an amazing program, but has been criticized in many areas for its, in the early stages of its over-optimistic flight rates and return on investments and those types of things. Were you kind of aware, was the office kind of aware that, look, a lot of these promises to Congress were sort of a little bit overblown and let's just keep going?
Yes, I had no idea of the the early Mathematica study, I guess, had like 60 flights a year, and I think when it settled down, they still were thinking 24 flights a year. So, but no, I had no idea of the marketing, if you will, and how many customers there really were to fly what number of flights, practically speaking, you know, and what the early on, of course, we had no idea what the turnaround requirements would be. There were several faults in the what happened in the program. We ran into weight problems early, number one. and we cut like 25% out of the wing area. We blunted the crew cabin. We blunted the Ohms pods. So it made it a worse glider. It seriously damaged decreased the lift to drag ratio, which is a measure of what a glider, good glider, is or not.
Sure.
And as a result, we exceeded the metallics capability. The first shuttle and the proposals were for metallic shuttle. There was no tile.
Oh, really?
Yeah, it was going to be mostly all titanium, Inconel X, like the X-15, and a material called Columbian. And so it was going to be an all-metal vehicle. And when we when the LVD lift to drag went down, it became a worse glider. Of course, it came in a little steeper, and heating rates went up to exceed the metal capability. So we're kind of saved by having the tile material, which I think had been developed in research and development by Lockheed, that could fill the gap and provide a system that could sustain the entry heating that it ultimately had to deal with. We also had funding problems early on in shuttle. I know in the orbiter office, we got about half the money of the program plan the first 3 years.
Sounds like a familiar problem.
What's that?
Sounds like a familiar problem.
It is, and we had to do some, I'll call it extraordinary things with requirements or taking content out of the program to try to make ends meet and still hold schedule. For instance, Challenger, the shuttle that later, a tragedy coming off the launch pad on launch that blew up. That was never supposed to be a flight vehicle. That was our structural test article that we took to about 80% loads only and did away with fatigue test. It was also supposed to be fatigue test article. That way we preserved the hull that we could turn into a flight vehicle. We did away with a lot of testing planned. We didn't. Only thermal test, vacuum thermal test we did was one payload bay door and one Ohms pod. We did, that's it. That's it. We said we'll get the rest of the data on orbit. Really, to me, was pushing and taking risk. The only vibroacoustic we did was the F section of the orbiter. We did no crew cabin vibroacoustic. And you have to appreciate the vibroacoustic environment for shuttle was much worse than Apollo. On Apollo, we were way up on top, well away from the engines.
Sure.
The orbiter rode right with the engines, and particularly the solids right beside it. So we had to actually beef up the vibroacoustic facility at Johnson Space Center to do the test to increase the decibels for the vibroacoustic testing on that aft thrust structure because it's much higher than Apollo.
Of course.
So those kind of things were done to try to take it out of the program, to try to save money. And another Enterprise, originally we had a second Enterprise. We had another vehicle to do the test program, and we deleted it early on.
Right.
So we had no backup vehicle, which normally you want in a test program because you can't expect problems.
Mm-hmm.
So we had no backup for Enterprise.
Sure. So... You never flew the space shuttle. You left the program before it actually got into space in 81. Can you tell me why that was, Fred?
I would have stayed had we kept the mission. Jack Lausman and I were scheduled to fly the mission, which was to rescue Skylab. We were going to go up, and Jack actually would remotely fly a vehicle we were going to carry in the payload bay. After we'd rendezvoused and set off a little ways, he was going to fly this vehicle over and dock it with at one end of Skylab. And then people on the ground would take over and orient Skylab the right direction and actually fire the propulsion system on this little flyover vehicle, which would either boost Skylab higher or more gracefully deorbited, which, as you know, it wasn't quite as graceful, and I think components of it fell in Australia, in fact.
That's right. Thank you for that. We appreciate that.
Yeah, right. And that mission went away. So then the mission was primarily going to be one of the earlier testing of the RMS arm, Canadian arm, and to collect thermal data. sitting in orbit and going and sitting in various attitudes for certain durations of time and collecting thermocouple data. So the mission just wasn't, call it, as exciting as I had hoped. And I had the opportunity, because I always wanted to get into program management. That's why I went to the Orbiter Project Office to get a little on-the-job training. And an opening at Grumman was offered to become vice president of space programs at Grumman Corporation in New York. So I decided not to pass up that opportunity and start my next career path.
Wonderful. Of course, Grumman was the manufacturer of the Apollo lunar module.
That's correct. Grumman, and that was a familiar territory for me because I had spent lots of months at Grumman during that phase in Apollo testing lunar modules. So I knew pretty much most of the program management people at Grumman.
And that was Fred Hayes in conversation with the space show's very own Peter Irwin. We recorded that 2 weeks ago. Now, you heard him there say that he was going to be on the mission that was going to save Skylab. Yes, the idea was the shuttle would go up and grab Skylab and put a little rocket on it and save it, but it didn't happen. So here is a group called the Astronuts with the song Skylab is Falling.
In mid-July, there was to be a catastrophe. It could have hit you, or it could have hit me. Have you heard spread the word? Skylab has fallen. Skylab has fallen. Skylab. Did it burn up? Is it came down? Did you stay or go underground? Out of control, somewhere in space. I knew it had to crash someplace. Skylab, Skylab has fallen. Skylab, Skylab has fallen. Skylab. Just the way they are. We don't need falling metal stars that make us fall. Just hope and pray that when they fall, we're not in the way. So much to lose for what we've paid. Have you heard spread the word? Skylab has fallen. Skylab has fallen. Skylab. Skylab has fallen.
You're tuned to the great Bayside sounds of 88.3 Southern FM.
Did you know that there are 6 people living in space right now? The Space Show keeps you up to date with all the action at 7 p.m. on Wednesday nights. Join us.
And just a reminder of the event on April 12th, that's this coming Sunday between 2 and 6 p.m., the Apollo 13 anniversary event in which we'll be screening Ron Howard's movie, Apollo 13. This is going to be at the Backlot Studios at 65 Hague Street, and Darren Hinch is going to appear in person, and Fred Hayes has recorded a special audio message for us. So don't forget, if you have booked for that, this coming Sunday between 2 and 6pm at the Backlot Studio. And just a reminder that there are now six people in space, and two of them are about to do a one-year mission. And this will be the fourth time in history that people have stayed 1 year in space or longer. But right now, we're out of time. It's 8 o'clock.